Good evening. Total devastation in the Bahamas as Dorian stalls. Parliament challenges Boris Johnson on the no-deal Brexit, a protest in London to free Julian Assange, and a glimpse into the FBI's interest in Bob Dylan. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Tuesday, September 3rd, 2019. Dorian has now begun its anticipated climb up the southeast coast of Florida. Tropical storm force winds are now occurring along the Florida east coast at wind gusts up to 49 miles per hour. Several coastal counties have been evacuated along the eastern seaboard of Florida, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Georgia. Virginia has declared a state of emergency. Oliver Sampson reports.
The devastating hurricane has been downgraded to a Category 2. Its maximum sustained winds dipped to 110 miles per hour after peaking at 185 miles per hour over the weekend. Officials at the National Hurricane Center say that this is not a cause for reassurance. They believe the combined wind, surge, and flood hazards could pose an even more dangerous threat. Ken Graham is director of the National Hurricane Center.
We still have this hurricane warning along the Florida coast. We also have the hurricane warning on portions of South Carolina coast and the hurricane watch along the North Carolina coast, right up to the Virginia border, and that's areas that could see hurricane force winds.
Back in the Bahamas, Dorian is now categorized as a tropical storm, but it left at least five dead with more than 13,000 homes severely damaged or destroyed, according to the Red Cross. Bahamas Prime Minister Aram Lewis said that the death toll is likely to rise, specifically in Abaco and Grand Bahama. Dangerous winds are expected to continue to impact northwestern Bahama this evening. While Dorian is the main focus of forecasters, there are four more weather disturbances in the Gulf of Mexico and in the Atlantic Ocean that are being monitored. Tropical Storm Fernand formed this afternoon, and three other tropical waves could become tropical depressions as well. Oliver Sampson, WBAI News, New York.
And meanwhile, during a briefing on the once Category 5 hurricane that did widespread damage in the Bahamas and threatens the United States coast, President Trump said on several occasions he'd never heard of a Category 5 storm. According to reports, he said the same thing at least four times in the past 2 years.
I never even knew a Category 5 existed, and they suffered greatly.
They say they've never seen winds like this. Anywhere, got hit as a Category 5 storm, which literally never happens.
The second one hit Puerto Rico as a Category 5. I don't believe anybody's ever seen that happen before.
It was like having hundreds of tornadoes, the winds. So we've never seen it. Actually touched down as a Category 5. People have never seen anything like that.
And this has been a Category 5, which few people have ever even heard of. A Category 5. Nobody's ever heard of a 5 hitting land.
I saw the devastating effects of that Category 5 hurricane. Category 5. Never heard about Category 5s before. Category 5 is big stuff.
I'm not sure that I've ever even heard of a Category 5. I knew it existed, and I've seen some Category 4s. You don't even see them that much. But a Category 5 is something that I don't know that I've ever even heard the term. Other than I know it's there. That's the ultimate, and that's what we have, unfortunately.
In September 2017, nearly 8 months into Trump's presidency, Hurricane Irma, one of the strongest Atlantic Basin hurricanes ever recorded outside the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean Sea, affected at least 9 U.S. states. That same month, Hurricane Maria devastated the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico, leaving behind an island that's still struggling to recover. Last October, Hurricane Michael, which was originally designated as a Category 4, barreled into the Florida Panhandle as a third Category 5 hurricane to blast the U.S. since Trump was elected. And in international news, a cross-party alliance defeated Prime Minister Boris Johnson in Parliament on Tuesday in a bid to prevent him taking Britain out of the EU without a divorce agreement, a move that the government warned would thrust Britain towards an October snap election. More than 3 years after the United Kingdom voted in a referendum to leave the European Union, the defeat leaves the course of Brexit unresolved, with possible outcomes still ranging from a turbulent no-deal exit to abandoning the whole endeavor. Veteran journalist Ian Williams says British politicians are running out of options on Brexit, and the country may face new elections if Johnson can't keep his majority in Parliament.
At one time, a prime minister could simply call an election whenever they wanted. So prime ministers, if they felt they were on a winner, they would call an election regardless of how, you know, what period of their term they were in, simply to prolong their stay, because they could get another 5 years if they hit the right moment. Sometimes they miscalculated and lost. But in general, a prime minister would only call an election when he thought he was going to win. Then to stop that, as part of the big deal with the Liberal Democrats, they insisted on a parliamentary bill which had fixed 5-year terms, which is an innovation for Britain in recent years, and set a lot of conditions to limit the power of the incumbent party to sort of prolong their stay, prolong their terms this way, so that they couldn't just call it. There's strict rules. 2/3 of members of parliament have to vote to call an election. So that's the position they're in now. And what's happened is all of these sort of various deals, and they've managed to paint themselves into various corners. For a start, they agreed with the deal with the European Union that the customs union between Northern and Southern Ireland would stay there regardless, the famous backstop. Britain could be tied into European Union trading rules without a vote if it didn't come to some type of agreement with Ireland and the European Union about the border in Northern Ireland. That is what Boris is trying to overturn now. Boris Johnson is trying to overturn. It limits him. You know, it's an international treaty on the one hand, and it's a matter of a government pledge. And he also depends upon a group of fanatical Protestant loyalists for his current parliamentary majority, which incidentally he lost today because one of his Conservative MPs defected to the so-called Liberals. So he's in a sort of real cleft stick, and the manoeuvring now is whether he actually wants an election or doesn't. Now, hitherto, Jeremy Corbyn and many in the Labour Party have wanted an election because they thought they stood a good chance of winning it. But if the election comes on a Brexit or no Brexit deal, then no one's at all sure what would happen. It's quite possible that the anti-Brexit party might actually win a majority in many areas, or at least win many seats off the Conservatives. So at the moment, we have the position that Boris Johnson has taken power, not because he was elected as Prime Minister, remember, upon a general election, but because of his inner party manoeuvrings. The Conservative Party ditched their previous leader, who was also unelected, and replaced it with Boris. And, you know, just to confuse this democracy bit, Boris had to be elected by, nominated by a significant number of Conservative MPs, but then his election had to be ratified by a majority of actual Conservative Party members. And in Britain, to be a member of a party, it's not like declaring yourself a Democrat or Republican or Independent in Britain. You actually have to join the party. You apply to join and you pay money and you vote in the various branches and constituencies. Here we have a small and shrinking group of Conservative members, increasingly, like the Republicans, dominated by far-right thinkers and chauvinists, and they are overwhelmingly pro-Brexit, which isn't the view of the people who write the checks in the Conservative Party in general. So you've got this weird dilemma of Boris representing the members of the party, but not representing necessarily the voters of the party or the people who write the checks. And then on the Labour side, you have many of the Labour voters instinctive anti-European Union. This mixture of both chauvinist reasons and they saw what the European Union did to Greece and France, and they saw what it did, that they confused Margaret Thatcher's tenure with the European Union. They saw what happened in the industrial areas of Britain after Britain joined the EU, and they associate this together, even though it was Margaret Thatcher's staunchly independent, patriotic British policies that did most of the damage. You have a very confusing issue coming up.
What's going to happen, in your opinion, in the next few days?
There's really so many factors involved, it's difficult to predict. But there seems to be something of a consensus that Boris Johnson wants to precipitate an election because he thinks on a Brexit deal, he will be able to attract both the far-right voters who are Brexit at all costs and some of the Labour Party voters who are opposed to what they think is the Remain turn by Jeremy Corbyn. For the last 3 years, the old Blairites have been attacking Jeremy Corbyn as a Brexiteer, when in fact he's made the most articulate case for staying in of any of the leaders and campaigned very hard. But He's campaigned for Remain and Reform. He's not campaigning saying the European Union is some type of utopia, some type of Shangri-La. He's saying it's bad, but if we pull out, we'll be in an even worse condition. And if we stay in, we can do something about it. This is the position now. George W. Bush was a pioneer. No one wants nuance in their speeches. They want straight black and white caricatures.
Veteran journalist Ian Williams. Let there be no doubt about the consequences, Johnson told the MPs after the result of today's vote was announced, accusing the parliament of being on the brink of wrecking any deal with Brussels by taking the possibility of unilateral Brexit off the table. And you're listening to the news on WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Activist musician Roger Waters showed up yesterday at the United Kingdom's Home Office in London to support imprisoned journalist and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. He sang his Pink Floyd hit, Wish You Were Here.
So you think you can tell heaven from hell, blue skies from pain, can you tell it? From a cold steel brick, a smile from a veil. Do you think you can tell? And did they get you to trade your heroes for gold?
And journalist John Pilger had delivered a stark warning from WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange, who said that his persecution is intended to kill dissent. Speak up now, Pilger said, or face the silence of a new kind of tyranny.
When I asked Julian what he'd like me to say today, he was adamant. Say it's not just me. It's much wider. It's all of us. It's all journalists and all publishers who do their job who are in danger. In other words, the danger Julian Assange faces can easily spread to the present and past editors of The Guardian, The New York Times, Der Spiegel, El País in Spain, The Sydney Morning Herald, and many other newspapers and media outlets around the world that publish the WikiLeaks revelations about the lies and crimes of our governments. Never before in my career as a journalist have I known such an attack on our most basic freedom to publish and to know. The message is loud and clear. Be careful, or you too will end up in an American hellhole. Journalism is not a crime in the United States, not yet. But if Julian is extradited and convicted, it will become a crime. Journalism that does its job and tells people what governments do behind their backs in their name. Julian is not an American. He is an Australian citizen. WikiLeaks, which he founded, is not a US-based publication. But the meaning of his extradition could not be clearer. No matter who you are or where you are, if you expose the crimes of government, you will be hunted down, kidnapped, and sent to the US as a spy. 17 out of the 18 charges that Julian faces in America relate to the routine work of an investigative journalist, which is protected under the First Amendment of the US Constitution. The 18th charge about hacking doesn't even relate to him, and even the prosecution over there say that. The whole thing is a sham. The US prosecutors know it's a sham. A federal judge recently declared, effectively, it's a sham. The British government know it's a sham. The Australian government knows it's a sham. That's why Julian is locked up more than 21 hours a day in a maximum security prison and treated worse than a murderer. Why is that? Why is he not protected by international law as the United Nations Working Party has demanded? He is to be made an example, that's why. What happens to Julian Assange and to Chelsea Manning is meant to intimidate us, to frighten us into silence.
Journalist John Pilger. Assange is currently serving a 50-week sentence in Belmarsh Prison for skipping bail, a bail hearing in 2012. U.S. authorities are seeking his extradition for his role in publishing classified documents, accusing him of espionage. If extradited and convicted, Assange could be sentenced to 175 years in prison. And in local news, the City Planning Commission on Tuesday green-lighted Mayor Bill de Blasio's controversial plan to shutter the scandal-scarred Rikers Island prison complex and replace it with four new, smaller borough-based jails. Commissioners voted 9-3 in favor of building new jails in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx, but were drowned out trying to explain their votes by a crowd of nearly 100 opponents. Many of them accused the commission of being filled with white supremacists and not caring about local residents. The plan now goes to the City Council for final approval. Bronx Borough President Ruben Diaz Jr. spoke with WBAI a few moments ago. He says the mayor is treating the Bronx as a second-class borough.
We believe that Rikers Island should be closed. We are not saying not in my backyard. What we're saying is treat us like you would treat other boroughs, and let's do this the right way for future generations and put the jail connected to the courthouse. We've made our case abundantly clear. But unfortunately, the mayor, his cronies at the planning commission have turned their backs on the community once again.
Why do you think that is?
I think that the mayor has just wanted to take the path of least resistance. The fact is that the space is there at the courthouse, but you're also going to need another area where that the state also owns. I think that we could have come to some type of agreement. Everyone who made the decision to cite this at the Toe Pound did so not speaking to any one of us here in the Bronx, and no one at that table was even a Bronx resident. A, Rikers Island should be closed, but B, we should do it in the way where all of the advocates nationwide have said is the best approach, and that is to connect jails, smaller jails, to the courthouses so that you can have access to families, but also you can have access by the defense attorneys to their clients. It is the best way they could be the best prepared to be able to defend their clients and represent their clients before a judge. Under this plan, the mayor's selfish, short-sighted plan, every single person who unfortunately will find themselves as part of the system moving forward will be able to have all of those boxes checked, except for the county of the Bronx.
What is the value of the Toe Pound site? Why is the community so focused on saving that site?
When I was a teenager, when the Bronx had darker days, there was a crime and drug syndicate called the Wild Cowboys. They came right out of there. The people who live there today persevered. The Cowboys, the crack epidemic, and the murder wave that choked the Bronx during the 80s and the 90s. And life isn't perfect, but they made it a whole lot better there. And they have a plan that many of us, including the councilwoman and the prior council member in that area who is a former speaker, we all supported a plan for the Bronx, by the Bronx, to build housing, to create jobs, to build a recreational facility at that site. We had all agreed on it until now. The mayor totally turned his back on the hard work. And so he is a hypocrite, and anyone who would say that they listen to the community, they are a hypocrite. And we also heard that hypocrisy today from the commissioners that he appointed at the commission, who all said that, you know, we need to do better by the Bronx, that this could be a better location, and yet they still voted to move ahead.
What happens next?
I'm hoping that the people, the members of the city council, understand that, again, we need to close down Rikers Island. Yes, that we can all agree on. But if we're going to move forward, that we should do so in a way where we are going to address criminal justice reform for every single borough. In this case, Once again, the Bronx is receiving the short end of the stick.
And that's Bronx Borough President Ruben Diaz Jr. De Blasio intends to close Rikers by 2027 and move its detainees closer to courts and their families in every borough except Staten Island. It's part of a larger plan aimed at bringing the city's jail population, currently 7,400, to under 5,000 by 2027. In 2017, Rikers averaged about 9,400 detainees daily. The four jails are being built on the site of a nine-story government building at 80 Center Street in Lower Manhattan, the NYPD's Bronx Tow Pound in Mott Haven, the currently shuttered Queens Detention Center in Kew Gardens, and the Brooklyn House of Detention in Cobble Hill. The seven commissioners commission appointees who serve at the pleasure of de Blasio voted in favor of the plan, but three of the five appointees tapped by borough presidents opted to reject it. And finally, in May 1963, a young singer-songwriter named Bob Dylan released an album of original songs named The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan that swept him from obscurity on the folk music circuit centered in Greenwich Village to a career of international stardom.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing.
Featuring songs like Blowin' in the Wind, Master of War, A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, Oxford Town, and Talkin' World War III Blues, the album introduced a new hard-edged sound to political music and became anthems of a generation. The album featured an iconic photo of Dylan and his girlfriend at the time, 20-year-old Susie Rotolo, walking arm-in-arm on a snowy New York City street. Little did the couple know that Rotolo and probably Dylan as well were already in the sights of the FBI. Rotolo, since who passed away in 2011, had been followed by the FBI since she was a teenager. Researcher and author Aaron Leonard got Rotolo's FBI file as part of research for a book on how the feds followed musicians around in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. His article, FBI Tracking of Bob Dylan and Susie Rotolo, Foreshadowed Future Abuses, is at truthout.org. He spoke with WBAI earlier today.
She ended up on the FBI's radar, it seems like, for two reasons. When she was 16, she was the girlfriend of the son of a prominent communist leader. The FBI was tracking the leaders of the CP in the late 50s and 60s really closely. So that was one thing that put her on the radar. The other thing is her mom and her were planning a trip to Italy. And when she filed for a passport, the FBI recorded it and started a file on her. So this was all going on before she met Dylan.
Who were some of these artists they targeted and why?
In the 40s and 50s, they targeted the folk singers, Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, Burl Ives, Cisco Houston. They all have files because they were either in or close to the Communist Party. The Communist Party was the preeminent preoccupation of the FBI throughout the 40s, 50s, and 60s, even though by the 60s the Communist Party had dwindled in strength and effect. It was a party that was sympathetic to the Soviet Union, and for the United States, that was taboo. After she broke up with Dylan, she took a trip to Cuba. A group called the Progressive Labor Party had helped sponsor the trip to Cuba to break the travel ban and, you know, challenge the blockade. Castro had come to power. The United States was very oppositional to that regime, and Rotolo and a bunch of other young activists with this group, you know, took a trip to Cuba, and that kind of solidified her presence in the FBI's records, which, you know, that's the reason the file continues. But the stuff with Dylan is fascinating. He's on record because he got an award, the Tom Paine Award, for some organization. In 63, Dylan was doing a lot of very overtly political music. His first album, Freewheelin', actually has a cover with him and Susie Rotolo, the subject of this file, on the cover. It's an iconic image. you know, the album has these famous songs, Blowing in the Wind, Oxford Town, which talks about a, you know, racially charged incident in the South, A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, these very highly charged, beautifully poetic songs. And Dylan is, he's a curious character. He's somebody, you know, my sense is he deliberately doesn't want to conform to people's expectations. So he gives a speech at this award, and this is like 3 or 4 weeks after John F. Kennedy is killed. And Dylan is kind of musing, you know, I think I kind of understand Lee Harvey Oswald, even though I never would have done such a thing. And, you know, he's booed, you know, at this ceremony. The FBI gets wind of it because it's a public event, and it's excerpted twice in Susie Rotolo's file. So that tells me that there's a bigger file on Dylan himself, which who knows all of what's in it, because he was, you know, right in the middle of the civil rights black freedom movement at that time, and he was being put forward by some as the voice of a generation. And in fact, you know, people still listen to Dylan today, the political stuff, and, you know, take certain messages from it, even though Dylan long ago distanced himself from that. It's just quite a trip. Dylan, that I know of, hasn't asked for his file, but I suspect there's quite a bit in there, because his overtly political and his even his later work was, you know, in many ways a kind of classic and challenged the status quo in many ways. But here there was just a confluence of things, you know, dating a red diaper baby, you know, saying things about Oswald, you know, that would have put him on their radar.
What is the lesson that activists and political artists today can learn from this?
Ted Cruz had recently called for a RICO investigation of what's popularly known as Antifa, these various forces that have been challenging, you know, these white supremacist and neo-fascist forces. You know, a RICO investigation would mean the full power of the FBI to go after people, investigate them, build cases, and send them to prison, all theoretically, if they can kind of mount the evidence to make that case. You know, and this is in 2019. The FBI has this mandate of ensuring domestic tranquility, which essentially means clamping down on forces that go outside of the bounds of what the status quo is allowable. It's really worth studying the past and understanding that this force, this FBI, is still there and still has a certain mandate. Don't be naive about who these forces are.
Researcher and author Aaron Leonard, he's the author of FBI Tracking of Bob Dylan and Susie Rotolo, Foreshadowed Future Abuses, at truthout.org. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, September 3rd, 2019. The news is produced with Linda Perry and Oliver Sampson. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.
Before she sleeps in the sand, isn't how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned?